Thank you. My name is Randall Mack, and I'll be chairing these proceedings this evening. I might ask, or we would like to request at the beginning here, that there be no tapes made of the proceeding tonight. Let me also ask you how many, just out of interest, have seen the film The Godmakers. Would you please raise your hand? We'll be showing a few scenes from the movie tonight. The film The Godmakers, which was first shown in 1983, was produced largely through the efforts of Ed Decker, who was currently international director of Saints Alive and Jesus. The film took 3 years to make at a cost of approximately $250,000. To pay for this film, Decker personally borrowed $65,000, obtained $50,000 from a group of investors, and raised the remaining amount from donations. According to one typical advertisement that appears in New Life magazine, this hard-hitting film unmasks the myths of Mormonism from family home evening through the actual secret temple rituals. Another recent advertisement discloses that this controversial film peels back the mask of lies to expose today's most respectful yet deceitful and fast-growing cult. Decker, a Mormon for 20 years before asking to be excommunicated in 1976, claims that the film is now shown to about 200,000 people per month. The film has been shown most often in California, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Arizona, and New Mexico, but efforts are being made by so-called missionary teams this summer to show the film in other states, particularly in communities where there are significant numbers of Mormons. In addition, the film has been shown in England, Finland, and several South American countries. A sequel to this film entitled The Temple of the Godmakers was released this summer. The film has created considerable religious controversy in many of the communities where it has been shown. It has been denounced both by church members and by persons outside the church. One spokesman for the church has described the film as religious pornography. A well-known leader of the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, after the film several times, concluded, "I sincerely hope that the people of all faiths will similarly repudiate the Godmakers as defamatory and untrue, and recognize it for what it truly represents, a challenge to the religious liberty of all." A question often asked after viewing the film and the literature distributed by Decker through groups such as Saints Alive and Jesus and Ex-Mormons for Jesus is, why has Decker become so obsessed with attacking the church? In one published interview with a reporter at the Seattle Times, Decker was asked, "Why do you do what you're doing? If you wanted to leave the church and go into something else, fine. Why not let the Mormons go their own way?" Decker answered, "Because God loves them." The reporter then asked, "Couldn't what you are doing be seen as just sour grapes?" Decker then answered, "It could, but believe me, there are a lot better things in this world that I would like to be able to do. I feel called of God to do what I do." Tonight we will take a critical look at this controversial film. We will first view several selected scenes from the film, which would give those of you who have not seen it an idea of what the film is all about. Following these scenes from the film, our first speaker will be Sharon Esplin Swenson. Sharon is currently director of the Utah Humanities Resource Center and an exhibition coordinator of the Utah Media Center. She also does film reviews for Network and teaches film theory in the Honors Program at the University of Utah. Sharon has received a BA and MA degrees in English from the University of Utah, where she is currently working on a doctoral degree in English. Sharon told me that she's particularly proud of her husband, Paul, who is the editor of Utah Holiday, and her two children. I might also add that her brother, Fred Esplin, is the business manager and a member of the Executive Committee of Dialogue. Her topic is entitled, "Does a Camera Lie? A Structural Analysis of the Godmakers." Our second speaker will be Alan D. Roberts. Alan is a historical architect with Wallace N. Cooper Architects and Associates, and is also the editorial associate and a member of the Executive Committee of Dialogue. He is formerly the co-publisher of Sunstone and president of the Sunstone Foundation. Alan has had various theological and historical articles published in Sunstone, Utah Historical Quarterly, and Utah Holiday. He and his wife, Dawn, are the parents of five children. Alan's topic is entitled, "The Godmakers, Shadow or Reality, a Content Analysis." Our final speaker will be Don A. Eagle. Don has been the Arizona Regional Director of the National Conference of Christians and Jews since 1965. He has also served as Vice President for Field Development of that organization, supervising work in 10 major cities in the Southwest. Don was ordained to the ministry of the Disciples of Christ in 1948, after having received his Master of Divinity degree from Drake University. He served as a pastor for the Disciples of Christ for 8 years before joining the National Conference of Christians and Jews. He has been given numerous awards over the years, including the Leadership Award from the Church of Castle Hills, the Religious Award, and the Outstanding Citizen Award from Phoenix's Human Resource Department, the Liberty Bell Award from the County Bar Association in Phoenix for contributions to the advancement of law by a non-attorney, the Distinguished Presence Award by the Kiwanis International, and the Humanitarian Award by the B'nai B'rith. Don and his wife Dorothy are parents of 2 children. His topic is entitled, One Community's Reaction to the Godmakers. Following our last speaker, we will invite questions from the audience.
Before we begin, I wanted to show you a selection of clips from the film, and I'm going to be your projectionist. And I wanted to explain a little bit about the film. The film is about 58 minutes long. We've extracted 10 minutes of clips to provide a sample. These include the prologue, the opening scene of the film, prologue, and an introduction of the story of the film, the frame story, which is Mr. Decker and Richard Baer approaching 2 attorneys in Los Angeles about the possibility of filing a suit against the LDS Church. There'll be a short break, then a second clip, an animation sequence that was Decker and Baer show the attorneys to show the difference between Mormons and Christians. This is how they introduce it. After this clip, in the body of the film as a whole, there are interviews with a variety of people, authorities on Mormonism, people who have been members of the church who are no longer members, a couple of people who work with the church and are speaking for the church. And then the third clip is a very short discussion. Oh, there's also a reenactment of the LDS temple ceremony as part of that. The third clip is a very brief discussion of temple garments and certain semantic, satanic links of certain words to the church. The fourth clip is the closing segment of the film, which opens with Eugene Eliasson, who appears earlier in the film with his surviving son, reading a suicide note left by his 16-year-old son, Kip. We'll go ahead and show the film and then proceed with the rest of the presentation. Mr. Webber.
Thank you. we have to dig into it. We need to expose it. We need to open it up to the truth.
Years later, a young treasure
rule over other planets and spawn new families throughout eternity. The Mormons thank God for Joseph Smith, who claimed that he had done more for us than any other man, including Jesus Christ. The Mormons believe that he died as a martyr, shed his blood for us, so that we too may become gods.
The mic reaching all over? Can you all hear us? Raise your hand. Yes, okay, thanks. Thanks, Kathy, thanks for doing it. We wanted to thank Mr. Decker, who made this film available and gave us permission to use these clips. And again, you've seen about a sixth of the total film. Does the camera lie? Yes, of course it does. If you have your driver's license or your passport and can look at the picture of yourself, you know in a second. You certainly don't look like that representation of yourself. We know, too, that moving pictures lie. They can deceive by what is included, what is excluded, how elements are arranged within the camera. We could do a movie here tonight and show either this was a wonderful session by focusing on happy, delighted people, or show it was horrible by people sleeping and yelling and stamping their feet. So you can clearly select material. There's a difference, too, in how sound is used. You don't simply have an image. You have an image with sound. What is the film? Ed Decker says he started work on the film in 1979. The credits at the end copyright some material from Conspiracy Cult and Journey to Kolob as early as 1980. The final film was released in this form in January of 1983. A shorter film, Temple of the God Makers, which includes the temple ceremony from this film and some outtakes from the God Makers, is also in release in a shorter version. Decker says that the God Makers is a straightforward documentary critical of Mormon religion. In the Seattle Times, he's quoted as saying, "The actual lies that the Mormons have fed are themes that we deal with." He told the Salt Lake Tribune reporter, "The movie is an impact film. It is meant to be an impact film. Our ministry is to bring Jesus of Calvary to the Mormon people." Publicity on the film, and you've already heard this from Randall, says this hard-hitting film unmasks the myth of Mormonism from family home evening to actual secret rituals. Other publicity says this controversial film peels back the mask of lies to expose today's most respectable yet deceitful and fastest-growing cult! Why do concerned pastors find this shocking expose essential viewing for the congregation? Because 30,000 door-to-door Mormon missionaries lure over half their converts from Christian churches. This is again from their publicity on the film. Is The God Makers a documentary, an impact film, a hard-hitting unmasking and expose, religious pornography, propaganda? There's an obviously wide divergence of opinion. I am looking at the film in terms of the way the essential elements of filmmaking structure a response. The narrative structure of the film suggests it is a documentary, a celluloid collection of documents considered as evidence in a legal trial. These are documents that are real, factual, actual, can be examined. Film documentaries have existed as long as the cinema itself. There's a noble tradition of the cinema verite, of film truth, which attempts to record reality as it is, unvarnished. Underlying this is a premise that we can know reality as it is and agree upon it and have some consensus among us. Is the film an effort to objectively present information so the viewer can learn what Mormonism is and decide how he or she feels? Or does it provide a specific point of view of Mormonism which it hopes to persuade viewers to accept? Any film structures meaning in a variety of ways. And my basic critical assumption is that the important determination of what the God Makers mean arises from the interaction of the film and the viewer, not from statements of the filmmaker or critics. How does the God Makers use the elements of film to structure a response? What is that response? All films, fictional or documentary, use certain elements. These include the narrative or story or plot. This is what happens when you've got a timeline of some kind, you've got action. Secondly, there are characters, actors, interviewers, interviewees, who the action happens to. Third, there is camera movement and placement. Editing, the juxtaposition of images, the way things are put together. Sound, which would include voiceover narration, dialogue, music, special effects, creaking doors, as you heard. Sets, locations, the ambiance, the mise-en-scene, the way people are arranged within the frame that you see on the screen. Then there's lighting and You have natural lighting. You have Frankenstein lighting down below your chin to make you look horrible, or lighting behind you to make you look angelic. I always like backlighting. I feel it adds that air of certain credibility and frailty that I lack in otherwise. The narrative of the Godmakers, to take the first element I mentioned, is ostensibly linear in time. The action occurs real time within an office of two attorneys in Los Angeles. Within this reality, the film's narration moves fluidly through time and space. A brief animation sequence is projected in the attorney's office, a projector propitiously being present. Is that true in your office, Diana? A lot of attorneys don't have a 16-millimeter projector. One of the two protagonists, but the taped interviews with a multitude of people occur in the film in a wide variety of locations without explanation about where you're going and to whom. There's some identification by the narrator. And the narrator occurs in the opening sequence as you hear an unidentified voice speaks, telling you certain facts, moving from Hawaii to the airport in Los Angeles, stopping with these two gentlemen that you saw at the beginning making their opening statements. One of the two protagonists, Ed Decker, and I use protagonists in the literary sense here. I'm not labeling or valuing, and I try not to. One of the two protagonists, Ed Decker, suddenly speaks in the course of the film to the camera without his jacket in a comfortable chair near a desk in what appears to be his home. Never any explanation of how he comes to be sitting there or why he's sitting there. No explanation for the transition is made. We, with the camera, move inside and outside of various homes and offices, including an LDS visitor center, to Hawaii, Great Britain, Seattle. That last thing you saw was the woman in the closing scene. There's a group of people waiting outside the Seattle Temple before it's dedicated, and they are interviewed by a woman who is not otherwise identified. Salt Lake City and in historic Cold Fort, Utah, where one memorable interview occurs beneath a stuffed buffalo head with the interviewee in pioneer costume. No comment or explanation of these voyages is made. We simply move through time and space, and in the course of watching the film, you accept it without question. Film time and real time seem identical. You have the sense you are in an attorney's office, that a period of time is passing, 58 minutes, and you're being presented with the evidence. The only thing I've seen that can equal this kind of cosmic hopping and moving around is the Mormon miracle pageant in Manti, where you go from the Holy Land to 19th century New York to pioneer Utah to contemporary Boy Scouts. And it's a mind-boggling trip if you're interested in dramatic time, space, and location. Obviously, the supernatural has more influence than we can judge in drama. We do not see in the film through a single person's eyes or point of view, though the controlling consciousness is clearly that of Decker and Bear. The deep, portentous tones of the narrator, an authoritative, informed, eternal point of view, speaks ex nihilo. We don't know where he comes from, we don't know where he is, we don't know who he is, but we know a great deal about his ability to make decisions based on the fervency of his voice. The impact of the narrative form is relevant to the film's message. You, as a viewer, are the judge of the evidence presented, and the implication of the structure is that you are reviewing testimony from witnesses on both sides of the case. Witnesses speak directly to the camera, which is you, and no interviewer is visible or suggested. There's one exception, which is at the Seattle Temple, where you hear the woman's voice and know it's obviously an interviewer. Now, cross-examination or clarification of evidence is possible in this pseudo-legal presentation, but the impact of a courtroom drama is suggested and maintained, and you are the judge and the jury. The final scene suggests a course of action, as well as an attitude, as well as a mind-boggling movement in space from where you are to close the door. At this point, it might be appropriate to discuss briefly what the style of presentation evokes. No film functions in a vacuum any more than any work of literature does. As C.S. Eliot said in Tradition and the Individual Talent, each new literary artistic work draws on and transforms the history of its form. While the ostensible manner of the presentation is documentary in The Godmakers, it evokes several other very familiar, classical genres. The first is Jack Webb's Dragnet. I said classical and I meant classical. We all have our classics. The music and earnest searching tone suggest Sergeant Joe Friday's efforts to elicit just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. The second is Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. The narrator's deep voice and the sci-fi music remind us of those bizarre, fascinating episodes that happen in a place between time. The other tradition is the 60-minute style television news program, a rigorous reportorial investigation of a matter clearly relevant to the public well-being. It also suggests March of Time and other kinds of news reels, which I'm sure you're all too young to have remembered, and I myself know only through archival footage. Let me put this very clear. The other allusion, and several people have mentioned religious propaganda. Several people feel that watching the film is like watching pornography, but since I have no experience and do not want to acquire any on pornography, I will leave it to your own experience and determination of the relevance of that classical genre. The action of the film within the trial framework is a presentation of the highly groomed, as they describe it, image of Mormonism, and the horrifying reality that lies beneath the mask. That's the action, basically. An important element in any film is the human element, are the characters, the actors. All the people in the film are presented as real people, ordinary people, although several are actors allegedly recreating incidents they were originally involved in, or that someone wrote about or informed them, and they found actors to recreate these. Quickly, the film includes, and this is an approximate chronological order, the invisible narrator, whose voice you hear initially, a man I call the stevedore, the man with the jacket over his shoulder who's standing and looking at you, a middle-aged man whose family is taken from him and he almost commits suicide. He is an actor. A bearded, artistic-looking professional man who lost his family, another actor. Ed Decker, Dick Baer, two attorneys, both actors. I call the one Doubting Thomas, he's in the velvet jacket and the sounds about slacks, and Mr. Silver Gray. These men are both actors. Harold Goodman, who was identified in the film as a BYU professor, former bishop, and present mission president. Harold Goodman, if you're not familiar with him, is a cherubic man with white hair and little cheeks. He doesn't want a pinch. He is photographed in front of some paintings in the visitor center. Brian Grant is identified in the film as director of public relations for the LDS Church in Great Britain and Ireland. He looks like a leprechaun. I mean, he's very cute. I mean, it's interesting to me how appealing these two spokesmen are. I don't want to, is it libelous to call someone a leprechaun? He looks like a leprechaun, he's not one. There are a couple I call Mr. and Mrs. Sports Shirt because I don't know their names and they're not given in the film. Very, very sweet people, slight southern accent on the woman. Very earnest people. People you would say, yeah, they look like Mormons, or maybe dry Mormons, as some phrase them. There are various people waiting in line to see the Seattle Temple before its dedication. You saw one woman in that last clip, and a woman interviewer who is heard but not seen. A man named Floyd McElvin, who is author of The Mormon Illusion, according to the film. Jolene Craig, she's a gorgeous blonde, and he looks like a football player. An unidentified teenage girl, very sweet, very attractive girl. A woman who has a pink daisy in her hair who lives in Hawaii. Another woman who has very short hair and who is just very lonely. Eugene Eliason, the man you saw at the end, and his son, surviving son. A woman named Selma Gere, who's identified as author, lecturer, and great-granddaughter of convicted Mormon assassin John B. Lee. The narrator of the animation, who is not the narrator of the rest of the film, he has a little bit more gravelly voice and somewhat kinder tone, less portentous, less authoritative. A family portrait with a woman, her husband, two teenage children, and a little blonde girl about 8 years old. The husband does not speak, but the woman does. Ron Prittis, who is identified as one of the editors of Seventh Seat Press, a journal designed or run by young Mormons who want to reform the church. Sandra Tanner, who is identified as an author, lecturer, and one of the greatest living experts on Mormonism. Charles Crane, identified as author, college professor, and expert on Mormon archaeology. Richard Sales, identified as author, lecturer, and archaeologist. And two unidentified young men dressed as Mormon missionaries, which you saw at the end. Everyone in the film addresses the camera directly, except the two attorneys. There is some semblance there of a discussion. Virtually everyone else is seated, facing the camera, or walking toward the camera during the course of their comments. The Mormons and the ex-Mormons are cheerful and hopeful. As I mentioned, I think Goodman, Graham, and Pritis are extremely hopeful. They could sell milk for the Dairy Council. These people seem to be real people. The ex-Mormons are portrayed as enlightened. The authorities are portrayed as either duped or duping. And we have Mormons shown as either fools or deceivers. But their very innocent appearance becomes sinister when you learn of the terrible things that Mormonism does to people and the terrible things Mormons believe. All the victims speak directly and honestly. I find them extremely convincing. They don't seem to be actors reading their lines. They seem to be people honestly sharing with you their experience. However, there are no stumblings, no you know, they're very polished, honest presentations. The camera and the movement and placement of the camera is very subtle but very important in the God Makers. The camera is extremely stable, very calm. It moves very slowly. It is generally stationary or moves very slowly. If you have a film with a lot of action, the camera moves quickly and jumpily, and a lot of cinema verite films show you the camera jiggling, and that's to give you a sense of things are really happening. They're catching it just as they happen. This is a very different scene in a very different mood. This is very calm, very steady. When a camera does move, it is dramatic. For example, there's a long path that pan up and down the church office building, accompanied by some very terrifying music. It was a very sinister camera movement. It makes the church office building very sinister, which it may be. I'm trying to be neutral. But the camera movement and the nature of the camera movement contribute to the sense of an innocent, wholesome exterior that conceals corruption and a great deal of pain and evil. The editing of the God Makers is extremely impressive. It is generally what we call invisible editing. Each shot is matched smoothly to the next shot, so you're not aware that a cut has been made. It is tight, each sequence flows from the next one, and they're linked on topics, on words, on ideas. So you have a sense of moving slowly, not an extremely long, dull. These are not talking heads, even though they're interviews. Even on the animation, if you notice, the camera moves on those still drawings. The camera moves up and moves down. In the temple sequence, there's a picture of a temple, of a ceiling room, and the camera moves in and moves out to give you a sense of movement. But always smooth, always graceful, always very carefully done to not call attention to itself. Even when you are moving through great leaps of time and space, the editing is done smoothly and flowing so that they appear to be logical, in fact necessary, movements and developments. And this is important in terms of the logic. Normally, in a journalistic interviewing situation, you have shots of the questioner and then reverse shots of the person answering, or you get a shot over the shoulder of the interviewer. No interviewer is seen in any of the scenes, and only once do we hear the question. It's as if the people speaking to us are answering questions we don't even have to articulate. They know what we want to know. The danger is that we may not formulate the questions that have not been answered. In fact, we may not think of the questions that have not been answered. At one point, a person is describing the pain when they felt when they received advice from a bishop to separate from their spouse. This is intercut with a shot of Harold Goodman saying, no bishop would ever advise anyone. Back to the person in a great deal of pain again. Happens again, secondly, with Grant intercut saying, only in extreme circumstances can I imagine any bishop advising anyone to divorce their spouse. Then back to the person who was genuinely and authentically perceived as feeling pain. The effect is to make these men liars. Because the intercut, they obviously were not speaking to the person. Obviously, we're not informed about this person. But the presence of their statement next to that person's statement creates, in a sense, a dialogue, a witness, a discussion that could not have happened, but in effect does happen in the film. Again, very smoothly. In a courtroom, you could ask, well, how would you answer that? Or what did you mean? There's no chance for that to happen in the film at all. The sound is perhaps the most flamboyant aspect, and I think you noticed listening just to the short clips we had, a lot of minor chords, a lot of musically associated, kind of noise that you know means something supernatural but hokey. And that's an important qualification. They're also the sincere voices of those people witnessing. They're are the smooth voices of Goodman and Grant. And eventually the voices become slick and unfeeling because of the conflict that plays in. There's a special creaking door at the end. To discuss the dialogue of the film seems a misnomer. It honestly appears to be people sharing what they feel and believe, and that the division in the dialogue becomes certain people lose credibility as the film goes on. Some instances of loaded language in the film, you heard some of them, but highly evolved humanoids, extraterrestrial humanoids, and a discussion of tithing being extracted from members. I believe Alan may deal more with some of those details. The set and all of the elements that we see there generally seem to be very natural, very neutral. There's some surprises, like the Red Day, very famous to Eliasson. But like everything else, there's a surface of normality, which in some instances becomes suspect. It's like a cheerful village in a Hitchcock movie just before the murder happens and the blood flows. You know, it's waiting to happen. So the innocence is not real. The lighting is very naturalistic, which is very hard to achieve, but it's very naturalistic, very simple. The attorney's office in the last scene is very dark, and I don't remember it would be that dark, but there seems to be no reason for that. The exception here is remarkable. The final scene, when the missionaries face you and the door wedge of the dark moves across the scene, is very striking, very vivid. Using my own experiences as a Geiger counter, I would say the film presents a wholesome family image that the church portrays and then begins to show you the evil underneath it. You can only conclude from watching the film, Mormons are either brainwashed or corrupt. They're hypocrites who preach family togetherness and love, but practice demonic rituals and punish anyone who deviates from a very rigid norm. The final result, even I think if you're skeptical of the kind of inquirer mentality this film also evokes, is a suspicion and distaste of all Mormons. I think secondarily and unintentionally, the film leaves you with a distrust of anyone who talks about Christianity and claims Christ. But the approach generates a queasiness. It's like a generic commercial that says Mormons and religion are bad. Finally, I want to say that personally, I found the film very well done despite its clumsy touches, and after studying it carefully, I required a respect for the energy and skill of those who made it. As a Mormon, its illogic and anger irritates and disturbs me. The women, especially in animation, are all blonde and buxom. They're clones. It's as sexist as most of the LDS films and publicity is. What disturbs me the most is not the depiction of sacred rituals or the misrepresentation of theology or generalizing from limited evidence. It's the very real pain that I can sense in these people. I can discredit elements of the film, quarrel with its manipulativeness, but one image stays with me from the film. It is the face of a woman. She is not strikingly beautiful, and she is not strikingly ugly. She sits alone. The camera is in very tight on her. Like many others in the film, she talks about discovering Jesus and the transforming joy he's brought to her life. But more bitter than that is her description of her pain. She says, I was a child alone in the church, I was married alone in the church, and I was a single woman again, alone in the church. Where is the love? I look at her, I want to reach out to her, and I know that at least in this instance, in the portrayal of this woman, the camera does not lie.
At the onset, before I present what I have written, I would like to make it clear that my observations and comments are entirely personal ones. I do not represent in any official or non-official way the LDS Church, nor is it my intention to function as a defender of the faith. My remarks are simply the reflections and impressions of one layman who, for the purpose of furthering the dialogue in this issue, has chosen to make public his response to having viewed the Godmakers. While it would be tempting to also discuss the book by the same title and the sequel movie Temple of the Godmakers, I will confine my comments to the content of the film, The Godmakers, for the purpose of narrowing the focus. I also would like to reiterate Mr. Mackey's request that my comments, the comments of all of us, not be taped or recorded in any way this evening. As the aerial camera pans across the white face of the beautifully situated Hawaiian temple, a narrator begins the film The Godmakers by stating, "It looks beautiful from the outside, but when you pull off the mask and talk to the victims, you uncover another part of the story. The documented evidence you are about to see may seem unbelievable, but it is all true." In this opening comment, we are quickly introduced to the idea that viewers will be watching a documentary, that some harmful evil will be uncovered, and that evidence and truth will be the instruments for making this evaluation. Ed Decker and Dave Hunt, in their recent book, The Godmakers, confirm that they consider the movie to be, quote, a documentary film. In support of this claim, we are told that 3 years of research went into the film. Certainly one might expect this of a documentary effort. Furthermore, aspects of the film's format suggest a documentary approach. Before attorneys, two would-be plaintiffs outline evidence which they hope might be used in a proposed lawsuit. The witnesses, one of whom is Ed Decker, maintain that the LDS Church is a dangerous organization bent on destroying people's lives. Decker and Dick Baer apparently hope to stop the church's activities through the intended legal action. Interspersed throughout the narrative are brief statements from longer interviews held with a variety of experts, persons both in and out of, for and against the church. Typically, an Orthodox Mormon spokesman will explain a church principle or practice. Then a non-Mormon or former Mormon will give countervailing information intended to undermine or refute the previous claim. The primary intent is clearly to try to show the failings and anomalies of Mormonism. In some places, animation is used to dramatize Mormon beliefs. What I've described thus far could conceivably be considered a documentary. And what are some of the documented findings and conclusions presented in the film? There are many, and they are very wide-ranging. I have identified some of the major themes which follow roughly in the order in which they are given in the film. One, Mormonism's personal character, both collectively and individually. Two, Mormonism as a satanic cult and practitioner of pagan temple ceremonies. Three, the credibility, or lack thereof, of Joseph Smith as prophet. Fourthly, Mormon sociological patterns. And fifthly, the credibility of Mormon scriptures. Within each of these themes and others, pro and con arguments are developed and many pointed conclusions are drawn. Consider with me several of the more interesting of these. And I expect, as you may have done when you watched the film, that each of you will judge for yourself the merits of each of these claims, most quoting directly from the film, as you will notice, or expressing as reasonable paraphrases. Number one, there are two aspects of Mormonism. The unreal one of friendly, loving, family-centered Christian appearances, which they call the mask, and the other of secrets and evil, the real church, described in the film as, quote, one of the most deceptive and dangerous groups in the entire world. There's a movie out called The Gremlin, which I haven't seen, I hope you haven't either, but one gets the impression that Mormons are sort of religious gremlins, kind of cute and warm, but murderous. Number two, Mormonism is, quote, incredibly effective in brainwashing its people. Mormonism is a cult, and is tied, quote, into occult and Satanism. Four, Mormonism is based on heretical doctrines, such as, I will quote several of these directly from the film, a worthy Mormon can become a god himself in the life hereafter, ruling over his own planet with a number of goddess wives. God is a perfected man. The whole Mormon doctrine comes from this idea about being God. Mormonism is far removed from Orthodox Christianity. Five, Joseph Smith was a tall tale teller and treasure seeker who was involved in the occult. He fabricated visions and made up the fictitious Book of Abraham and Book of Mormon. Joseph lied, made untrue predictions, practiced polygamy behind his wife's back, and thus is not credible as a prophet of God. Six, the Mormon Church pressures persons into divorcing spouses who do not measure up to church standards. Seven, church members, and incidentally women and children are mentioned only. Church members are under incredible pressure to be perfect. Because they can't be, they become depressed, they divorce, and or commit suicide. And the story of Kip is a very powerful one that is used as an illustration. Eight, LDS leaders know that church history, if fully known, could ruin the church. They use the nine versions of the first vision as an example. So the true history is hidden from members to protect the faithful. Nine, Mormons rewrite their scriptures and histories to hide inconsistencies and reinforce unity of belief today among present members. Ten, there is no archaeological evidence to support the claim that the Book of Mormon is an actual history of a real people. It is, to quote an alleged archaeologist, a fairy tale. Mormon claims of archaeological evidence are also untrue. 11, likewise, the Book of Mormon, or Book of Abraham, is not an authentic translation as claimed. 12, unlike Bible scholars, Mormons test their scriptures with a burning in the bosom rather than with archaeological evidence and textual criticism. 13, Mormons who have received temple endowments have consented to having their throats slit and hearts and vitals torn out. 14, temple ceremonies are occultist and include a fanatical program to evangelize the dead. This is a quote. 15, temple garments are magical and will protect faithful wearers from harm. 16, Mormons lie to achieve their ends. They lie about being Christians, about archaeological proofs of the Book of Mormon, about the power of garments. They circulate false stories about former members in order to do them harm. 17, Mormon/Utah Society leads or is among the nation's leaders in many societal ills. Specifically mentioned are divorce, suicide, child abuse, teenage pregnancy, DD, bigamy, bankruptcy, stock fraud. And lastly, the one that Sharon just mentioned, the church is without love. Former members feel alienated and empty because Mormonism has undermined their faith in the Bible and other churches. Persons leaving the church are in jeopardy of losing their spouses, their children, friends, and jobs. Having heard these conclusions, you will have judged them for accuracy according to your particular viewpoint. Some of you may feel that all of the statements are valid. Others may feel that they're all untrue. I suspect most will recognize that some are valid and others are not. Many more of you, I hope, are anxious to know what evidence has been advanced in the film to substantiate these points. At this juncture, I think it is timely to return to the idea that the Godmakers is touted by its creators as a religious documentary. I have seen many fine documentaries such as Life on Earth with Attenborough and The Voyage of the Beagle. These and documentaries in general utilize the scientific deductive process of searching for facts, objectively analyzing the facts, and producing defensible, tested conclusions based on the facts. Fiction plays little or no part and a real documentary. And while conflicts may be presented, strong pre-existing biases are subordinated to sincere investigative effort. The goal is to find truths and describe the documentation used to discover and test them. With the Godmakers, this process is reversed. A strong anti-Mormon mindset seems to have been firmly in place before the project began. Consider that the three stated goals of the Dekarite group were: one, to teach the true gospel to Latter-day Saints and bring them to Christ; two, to keep people from joining the church by negating the missionary effort; and three, to offer fellowship to those who have left the church and help heal their psychological wounds. Given these underlying purposes, was there any chance for a positive or even a balanced result? Probably not. The deck was stacked from the beginning. The three-year research effort was spent gathering information to support a predetermined conclusion about Mormonism. Rather than weighing the evidence and letting it suggest possible conclusions, the evidence was manipulated and shaped to support the anti-Mormon theme. The Godmakers, then, is really a one-sided exposé, a term incidentally used both in the film and on the cover of a Godmaker book. Redefining the Godmakers as an exposé rather than a documentary allows us to revise our expectations and better prepares us for the film's sensationalistic content. For in the Godmakers, we find the kinds of excesses we might expect in a film whose end is justified by any means. The Godmakers is marred throughout by faulty assumptions, flawed reasoning, oversimplification, innuendo, hyperbole, failure to distinguish between canonized doctrine and speculative theology, distorted interpretation of social statistics, unethical use of church spokesmen, proof texting, representing things unusual to be things typical, and inflation of the qualification of experts. Mr. Decker identifies himself as a former member of the Mormon hierarchy. To Mormons, this would imply that he had been perhaps a general authority, not certainly one of the tens of thousands of lay priesthood holders or local leaders. For non-Mormons, too, the impression would be that Decker occupied a very high ecclesiastical position, one allowing him to become entirely familiar with the inner workings of Mormonism. Obviously, it would be more face-shattering to Roman Catholics if the Pope or Cardinal denied his church than if a local priest were to do so. There seems to be deceitful intent here. And what about the expert doctors? Do they have academic doctorates in the fields they are commenting upon? Or are they ministers and armchair experts as intent as Decker on disproving Mormonism? The testimonies of Mormon experts are often presented out of context, while non-Mormon testimonies are quite pointed, score a lot of points. And importantly, two of the most persuasive anti-Mormons in the film, husband and wife, have recently rejoined the church after repudiating their comments in the film. This fact, of course, is not mentioned by any of those people who take the film around to town and present it. Now let me illustrate some of the other difficulties found in the film. It is inferred from state and federal reports on the state of Utah that Mormons have a higher than average incidence of divorce, teenage pregnancy, suicide, child abuse, alcoholism, etc. Their assumption does not acknowledge that better than 30% of the state's population is non-Mormon. Even more importantly, no account is made of the varying levels of religious activity among Mormons, given that perhaps 50% of the Mormons are not actively practicing their faith, as much as 65% of the state's population, if you include the non-Mormons, would not be expected to be fully committed to LDS tenets. A careful review of social statistics among committed Mormons underscores this point. For example, studies such as Utah and Demographic Prospective Regional National Contrast show that temple-married Mormons are 5 times less likely to divorce than LDS couples married outside of the temple, and 3 times less likely to divorce than couples married nationally. It should also be remembered that Utah's divorce rate is usually the lowest in the Mountain States, a region in which liberal divorce laws have led to nation-leading divorce rates. And while Utah has a higher rate of teenage marriage than exists nationally, Temple-married young couples under 19 have a divorce rate 5.5 times lower than the national average for the same age group. It is clear, then, that the point made by the Godmakers is actually true in reverse. Rather than being the cause of higher-than-normal divorce statistics, Temple marriages and religious behavioral orthodoxy are most closely correlated with much lower-than-average rates. In an attempt to portray Mormonism as a cult greatly removed from the mainstream of Christianity, numerous statements of what are considered to be Mormon doctrine are presented. Those ideas which would seem most anomalous to Christians are emphasized. Invariably, however, no attempt is made to distinguish between doctrine found in canonized scripture or official pronouncements and those many more speculative theories originating in obscure or non-authoritative statements circulating through the church in non-official oral tradition and folklore. Ideas of this latter type may offer interesting insights, but deal with unrevealed matters and open questions. These ideas are not considered binding on members, nor do they contain knowledge essential for exaltation. Here are some of the statements misrepresented in the Godmakers as being official Mormon doctrine. I think we saw many of them tonight on the film, and you'll recognize these. 1, Jesus, according to Orson Pratt, had at least 3 wives and fathered children, a direct descendant of which was Joseph Smith. 2, husbands and wives who have successfully achieved godhood will be required to populate their own planet by providing as many spirits as possible. The idea of being required to populate the planet with as many people as possible. Elohim, conceived by a god father and mother as a spirit, then got a body from mortal parents. He became a god through obedience to Mormon teachings and death and resurrection. Regarding Kolob, here the god of Mormonism and his wives, through endless celestial sex, produced billions of spirit children. You wonder how he had time to help people out in any other way. Those who remained neutral in the war in heaven were cursed to be born with a black skin. Not doctrine. Elohim and one of his goddess wives came to earth as Adam and Eve to start the human race. Later, Elohim came to earth to have sex with the Virgin Mary in order to provide Jesus with a physical body. A woman in the film says, quote, "Without a husband that could take me to the temple, I wouldn't be able to go to heaven and be with my heavenly father." Later, another woman says, "Women don't even get out of the grave, don't ever get out of the grave unless the husband calls them forth on the morning of the resurrection." Again, many of these ideas may sound familiar, you may believe them, but that doesn't necessarily mean their doctrine. Here is another. Mormons are instructed to use Christian terminology when talking to potential converts. The inference here is that the terminology of Christians and Mormons are different, that Mormons deceptively use Christian terminology when it's useful to do so, say to convert someone. Actually, they both use similar terms but understand them differently, which is a matter of cultural difference more than a matter of devious intent. We are told elsewhere in the film that temple-going Mormons are forbidden to associate with or sympathize with excommunicated or apostate members. Actually, members are encouraged to love and fellowship former members and help them with their burdens. Similarly, the film informs us that bishops routinely advise divorcing spouses who do not conform to church standards. Again, the opposite is true. Bishops rarely encourage divorce. The bishop's guide counsels bishops to try to preserve marriages at almost any cost. In fact, the church has been criticized in some circles for going to extremes to preserve unsuccessful marriages. In any event, Mormon attitudes toward divorce are probably not unlike those of other conservative religions. Putting together Utah suicide statistics and the tragic story of the suicide of the LDS boy in Idaho that we saw, it is implied that the church is responsible for the suicides of many of its youth. Yet there is no concrete evidence to support this assumption. It is doubtful that the moral advice given LDS teens is significantly different than that given by other conservative Christian clergymen. Kip's letter could have been written by any boy in any church. There is no reason to believe his experience was uniquely attributable to Mormonism. The Godmakers conveniently failed to mention that the main reasons for adolescent suicide are pressure to achieve academic success, declining participation in religious activity, and difficulty in acquiring a stable personal identity. The Godmakers also neglects to mention areas in social life, health, science, athletics, the arts, government, business, education, where Mormons have been leaders. One particularly troublesome misstatement probably jumped out of the film for knowledgeable Mormon viewers. In fact, when it occurred, I heard this big response. And this is the statement that, quote, "Joseph Smith claimed he had done more for us than any other man, including Jesus Christ." This is a close paraphrasing of Doctrine and Covenants 135, verse 3, with a very important exception that in John Taylor's verse, which reads, "Joseph Smith has done more, save Jesus only," or except Jesus, "for the salvation of men in this world than any other man that lived on it." This error has been blamed on the film's narrator, but obviously it could have been corrected or at least deleted. But obviously it better serves the purpose of the film to be left in its erroneous form. Another attempt to place Joseph Smith in a position superior to, or at least equal with, Jesus Christ informs us that Joseph, quote, "shed his blood for us so that we too may become gods." This view seems to make the prophet an atoner in the same way Jesus was. What evidence is there that this is Mormon doctrine? You may also have noted that in the scene with the man before the judgment bar, there were three persons behind the bar. In the middle was Joseph Smith, and to his sides were Jesus and Elohim. I think, again, trying to imply that he has a dominant role in the Godhead and trying to subordinate the roles of Christ and God the Father. To me, one of the most unsubstantiatable claims in the Godmakers is that Mormons worship Satan. I have long felt that the more fantastic a claim, the greater the evidence needed to support it. With the Godmakers, we find just the reverse. The wilder the claim, the more invisible the support. The evidence in this instance is that in a satanic Bible, which Mr. Decker held up, the word Mormo stands for a god who is, quote, king of the ghouls. And that in Chinese, a word sounding like Mormon means gates of hell. Surely, Mormons are unaware of these coincidences. Even if they were aware of them, they would not constitute worship of Satan. In my acquaintance with thousands of Mormons over the years, I have never encountered the faintest hint of satanic worship, nor do I know anyone else who has heard of such a thing. Certainly, one must prove intentionality to justify such an extreme claim. Pointing to a word in a book does not prove anyone ever intentionally worshiped Satan. In addition to these, there are other lesser falsehoods which reduce the film's credibility for informed viewers, but may seem plausible for the uninitiated. Here are a few. The Bible is mistakenly said not to be one of the standard works. The church is said to be a major stockholder in the LA Times, yet it holds less than 2% of the company's stock. We are told that tithing is extracted and that members pay mandatory tithing. Maybe some of you do, I don't know. The Seventh-East Press supposedly existed to, quote, "seek reform in the church through exposing Mormon cover-ups." We have the founders of that here. Perhaps they could respond to whether that's the case. I don't think it is. The Godmakers maintains that Mormon teachings are so little known because Mormons, quote, "are embarrassed by their own doctrine, so they don't talk about them." This seems to fly in the face of the more typical image of Mormons as often talking about their religion, trying to convert friends and neighbors. If Mormon teachings are so unappealing and embarrassing to discuss, why do converts join? Why do members stay? Why do former members return to the fold? The Godmakers implores us to take it seriously. At the same time, it is, like most exposés, sensationalistic and melodramatic. It is hard to treat it neutrally, dispassionately. It almost forces us into personal responses. I would like to conclude with my personal response. The manipulation and deliberate misuse of information aside, I was bothered by several other aspects of the film. The makers of the Godmakers seem to have a monolithic view of Mormonism. Repeatedly we hear that Mormons believe this or teach that. But Mormons do not believe or behave uniformly. Recent surveys of LDS belief and behavior, letters to editors, disagreements in classes, the variety of ideas expressed in church-related publications, the known ideological differences among general authorities, all reveal a high degree of pluralism within the Mormon tradition. It has been that way from the beginning. The Deckerites seem to have an equally simplistic view of traditional Christianity. It is assumed that there is a unified core of Christian dogma, and a false dichotomy is drawn here. There is Mormonism, and there is Christianity, as if they were each internally consistent as well as mutually exclusive entities. To view them in juxtaposition is to see black and white. But if anything characterizes Christian dogma, it is diversity. Predictably, the Godmakers makes virtually no attempt to show the Christ-centeredness of Mormonism. Anyone familiar with Latter-day Saint theology and teachings, lesson manuals, music, art, sacrament, ordinances, temple rites, scriptures, and prayers should recognize the dominant position held by Christ in the religion. And one might rightly question the authority by which the Godmakers advocates replacing a 20th century brand of 19th century restorationist Christianity, Mormonism, with a supposedly superior 20th century brand of earlier originating Protestant fundamentalism. Despite its purposes and flaws, the Godmakers may prove to be of some value to the church. How? It may be able to teach us something about ourselves. Why, for example, do some people seem to be vulnerable to this kind of presentation? Obviously, many are not adequately prepared to handle this kind of criticism of the church. Some people are permanently disturbed, while others are blown away. And this is true. I would like to suggest that there are a few lessons Mormons can learn from the film. One, however well-intentioned, well-prepared, or slickly packaged, propaganda has drawbacks for any group using it. Any group. I think Sharon has alluded to this. Second, high visibility, over-claiming, over-promising, over-expecting also present difficulties. I suspect that what is perceived as the arrogance of claiming to be the one and only true and right and authoritative church will continue to create barriers for many. A more ecumenical, tolerant spirit would greatly benefit the church. Three, attempts to close theological ranks on open questions by systematizing Mormon beliefs or adopting Protestant neo-orthodoxy may paint the church into a corner. There are advantages to our non-creedal, non-dogmatic diversity. Four, concealing important parts of our history from members and historians alike ill prepares them to deal with the kinds of issues introduced in the Godmakers. As pointed out last night by Professors Bushman and Schiff, one should not use our 20th century standards to judge the now unusual 19th century environmental influences affecting Joseph Smith and his contemporaries. That Joseph was a treasure seeker does not preclude the possibility that he could also have been a prophet. On the contrary, given what we now know about the pervasiveness of the religio-occultic phenomenon in the 19th century, it would be suspicious if early Mormonism had not been touched by it. Let us take greater advantage of our historians and historical resources. I expect a big round of applause for the historians. I'm sure the historians appreciate that. Mormons have long been taught that one is saved neither by ignorance nor on borrowed life. Knowledge is supposed to be good for us, a godlike attribute. Of course, if you believe it's heresy to be godlike, then probably knowledge isn't that important. Throughout the film, the church is depicted as an organization of such vast wealth, power, and influence as to be virtually unstoppable. It would seem to be to the church's credit, then, that this great force has not been marshaled against either the film or its makers. As far as I am aware, church leaders have thus far been silent on this matter. Ed Decker and his ex-Mormon cohorts learned many lessons from Mormons before their excommunication. It is ironic that both Mormons and Deckerites use slick, propagandistic films to persuade people to follow them. Both groups send out full-time missionaries and hold annual conferences. Both have produced a considerable amount of polemical literature, and both try to exploit the Mormon predilection for evidence, the need for tangible information to somehow buttress the temples of faith. Both groups lay claim to specialized knowledge, and both rely on a doctrine of apostasy to create a need for their respective higher understandings. The mainstreamers in both groups tend to have a black and white, right or wrong mindset. Both hold to conspiracy theories about opponents. These strong parallels, I think the Godmaker attitude is that turnabout is fair play. And all of these, a strange irony to me is that while the Godmaker accuses Mormonism of being devious and deceitful in its practices, the film is not above using the same tactics to accomplish the end of exposing the church. Only by misrepresenting their intentions, for example, did Decker and his group persuade active Mormons like Harold Goodman, Brian Clark, Ron Prittis to participate so willingly in what was to become a blatantly anti-Mormon production. Is their master and mentor Jesus or Machiavelli? For a group so adamantly insistent and reliant upon the Bible as its primary source of inspiration, why do we have a film which so radically departs from the loving, forgiving, constructive spirit of Christianity? While Jesus was not above criticizing errors in his society, his mission was almost entirely a positive one. And while Mormon missionary lessons discuss apostasy, most of the teaching effort is directed at constructing what Mormons consider to be a positive religious framework. I think one would fairly portray the Godmaker's film as basically negative and destructive in purpose and tone. From the Deckerite point of view, this is a legitimate way of being positive, I suppose. But it is a small wonder that many Christian churches have scorned the film and advised their members not to view it. Lastly, a comment on Mormon perfectionism. The Godmaker criticizes the dangers of Mormon strivings for perfection on the one hand, then on the other, condemns the imperfect actions of Mormons. It's a classical example of damned if you do, damned if you don't. I think it is necessary to acknowledge that while there may be aspects of the Church's thought, practice, and history worthy of criticism and improvement, the Church, led at all levels by fallible humans, is imperfect. Mistakes have been made and will be made again. But the prophets have been the first to remind us not to expect perfection of the Church or its members. It has been clearly stated that a prophet is a prophet only when speaking as a prophet. This principle has been held inviolate from Joseph Smith to Spencer Kimball. The Church seems always to have been interested in improving itself and its members. The law of eternal progression begins in the here and now. If there are weaknesses and errors, how can they be identified and remedied? I believe that there are a few ways. But in seeking the truth of a thing, one ought not to go to another whose only interest in it is to disprove and destroy it. There are better places and ways to get the knowledge we are seeking. And the Godmakers will not help us in this quest. At the beginning of the film, the narrator stated that, quote, "The documented evidence you are about to see may seem unbelievable. He was right about this. The Godmakers is more shadow than reality."
before we have our last speaker, perhaps we could stand up for about 30 seconds and take a break. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here with you tonight from Arizona, where when we left there was a nice rainstorm to add to our heat, and the humidity was going high, so it's nice to be here with you this evening. I'm conscious that tonight there was a political convention concluded in Dallas. Reminds me that 56 years ago there was another political convention in Dallas which nominated Al Smith, the governor of New York, for the presidency. There is a story which is told, possibly apocryphal, that in the course of his duties as governor of New York, Al was called upon to visit the inmates of Sing Sing Prison. And when he stood before the audience, he started out by addressing them as fellow citizens. And he immediately thought, of course, these men have lost their civil rights. That isn't correct. So he backed off a little and started again, and he said, fellow Democrats. That didn't quite seem right to him either, and so he tried a third time by simply saying, I'm glad to see so many of you here. And I guess it's him. I'm glad to see so many of you here tonight. I think it's important at the outset for me to define the National Conference of Christians and Jews for you. We're not a very well-known organization, but we are a nationwide nonprofit education agency established some 56 years ago. Our purpose was stated by our founders in these words: the corporation exists to promote justice, amity, understanding, and cooperation among Christians and Jews, and to analyze, moderate, and strive to eliminate intergroup prejudices which disfigure and distort religious, business, social, and political relations. A very enlightened statement for 1928. Our membership is composed of individuals of every race and creed, both men and women, clergy and laity, who subscribe to this purpose. They do not represent any group officially, but serve out of their own personal convictions. Our genesis was the concern of a group of distinguished American civic leaders for the virulent religious bigotry displayed during that 1928 national election campaign. The NCCJ was established to conduct nationwide education efforts designed to reduce and eliminate such bigotry, and to make it possible for citizens of every creed, race, and sect to participate in civic, social, and business life free from any impediment based on their personal religious beliefs or their ethnic origin. Being a purely voluntary association, the NCCJ has no power nor any desire to coerce any group or any person. We do, however, seek through dialogue and structured discussion to arrive at accommodations which may be accepted by groups or individuals who find themselves embroiled in civic or religious disputation, and thus advance civility, peace, and harmony within the community. The case under discussion tonight, namely the widespread showing of a film called The Godmakers, first came to our attention in Arizona as the result of an editorial commentary which appeared in the Mesa Tribune. The executive editor, Max Jennings, reported attending a showing of the film before some 1,500 people at Centennial Hall, sponsored by a group known as Concerned Christians. Their stated purpose was, quote, to reach out in love to those lost in Mormonism. Close quote. Editor Jennings commented, "If what I saw Tuesday night is love, I must have had the wrong Sunday school lessons back in that dusty West Texas Methodist church of my childhood. I didn't hear anyone reaching out in love Tuesday night. I heard people reaching out in hatred of another's right to believe what he wants. I heard people saying that Mormons are terribly wrong for holding the religious beliefs that they do, and that as many people as possible must be warned against the terrible Mormonism which destroys families and lives." End of quotations from Max Jennings' editorial. After the Mesa Tribune article appeared, one of the members of the NCCJ board in Phoenix, a Roman Catholic businessman, telephoned my office to apprise me of the story and to urge that the NCCJ become involved. Our first response was to issue a statement to the Mesa Press condemning religious bigotry and urging upon the citizenry, quote, "tolerance, respect, and goodwill toward those of differing religious belief and custom." We also telephoned several area clergy asking them to issue public statements. Some pastors did write such letters and they were published. Subsequently, the NCCJ received a letter accusing us of attempting to deny religious freedom and freedom of speech. The pastor wrote defending the group which had shown the film, saying, quote, "They see the Mormon people caught in a false religion and bound for hell. Because of their love, they are willing to take a stand for what they believe is right and true in order that Mormon people may find Jesus Christ as their personal Savior." This was typical of the responses I received. The controversy in Mesa resulted in a group of citizens which included a rabbi, a priest, and a minister, requesting an audience with the Arizona Regional NCCJ Board in order to express their concerns. They shared Max Jennings' view that the activities of concerned Christians had the capability of dividing a community such as Mesa. They asked the NCCJ to study the situation and to recommend a course of action. An ad hoc committee was named, composed of Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Mormons, blacks, whites, Hispanics, males, females, clergy, and laity. Through several meetings, the group sought to define its mission and to establish limits on what we should attempt to do. Eventually, we requested the leaders of Concerned Christians to meet with us, to show us the Godmaker's film, to answer our questions, and to discuss how we could arrive at mutual understanding. 17 persons from the NCCJ and 4 from the Concerned Christians met for nearly 3 hours. No real understanding developed from this meeting, but it became readily apparent that the ad hoc committee needed to hear from an informed Mormon leader in order to better understand and evaluate what we had seen and heard. Accordingly, Dr. Truman Madsen, Richard L. Evans Professor of Christian Understanding at Brigham Young University, was invited to address the NCCJ board on November 1, 1983. Dr. Madsen discussed Mormon belief, the content of the Godmaker's film, and the relationship of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with other churches and religions. Key points in Dr. Madsen's remarks were these, quote, If we want to know what a church believes, we should go to that source and not accept what outsiders and opponents say it believes. Quote, in any dialogue, we have an obligation to accurately present the opposition's position. This is very difficult, even when you try to do it with great honesty. What are the chances of accuracy when you are trying to do just the opposite? Of the Godmakers film, Dr. Madsen commented, quote, in the film, converts become victims, sacred commitments become highly secret ceremonies for the elite few, repentance becomes brainwashing, deep commitment becomes obsession, a church becomes a cult. To those engaged in presenting the film, Dr. Madsen said, quote, if you are against the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, then be against it for the right reasons. Don't create a monster and then represent it as the true Mormon Church. In the deliberations of the NCCJ Ad Hoc Committee, we were deeply sensitive to the religious freedom which we enjoy in this country. That concept of freedom is expressed in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The NCCJ operates with the sincere conviction that no body of government nor any private group of influence should violate the spirit of the Bill of Rights. We recognize that concerned Christians have every legal right to carry on their activities and to show their film to whomever they wished, no matter how the NCCJ or anyone else felt about it. One of the unique things about America is that religious groups may espouse any beliefs they wish about their own church or about any other group, including calling into question the truth of another church's doctrines, liturgical customs, or the character of the proponents of that religion. But a careful distinction must be made between our legal right to so act and the morality and wisdom of doing so. The NCCJ believes that we must use our freedom responsibly and that it must be exercised with self-restraint, fairness, good judgment, spirit of tolerance for the convictions and feelings of others. History is filled with tragic lessons when religious authoritarians, imbued with a sense of their own infallibility, have set out to convert non-believers, to correct those holding erroneous beliefs, and to bring the heretical to orthodoxy. How easily persuasion can give way to all manner of coercive methods, whether legal, psychological, or forceful. We need to learn the wisdom of the Quran, which says, quote, there shall be no compulsion in religion. On December 5, 1983, the NCCJ Ad Hoc Committee addressed a letter to the Concerned Christians of Mesa, Incorporated, expressing the reactions of the group of 17 who had viewed the Godmakers film. Among other things, the letter stated, one, that we recognize that personalized proselytizing activities are a common practice among numerous religious groups and that they are a natural expression of our religious freedom. Two, we question the wisdom of mass public meetings which had as their intent attacking the Mormon or any other faith's beliefs, sacred books, or leadership. We warned of the danger to community harmony if such activities continued and an acrimonious public controversy developed. we respectfully requested the concerned Christians to voluntarily reconsider their use of such programs. 3. Of the Godmakers film, the ad hoc committee made these statements. Quote, "The film does not fairly portray the Mormon Church, Mormon history, or Mormon belief. It makes extensive use of half-truths, faulty generalizations, sensationalism, and is not reflective of the true spirit of the Mormon faith." Quote, "We find particularly offensive the emphasis that Mormonism is some sort of a subversive plot, a danger to the community, a threat to the institution of marriage, and destructive to the mental health of teenagers." Quote, "We are of the opinion that the film relies heavily on appeals to fear, prejudice, and unworthy human emotion." Quote, "We believe that the continued use of the Godmakers poses a genuine danger to the climate of harmony and goodwill between neighbors of differing religious faiths." Quote, "It is basically an unfair and untruthful presentation of what Mormons believe and practice." The leader of the Concerned Christians group responded after about 2 weeks, and I should be fair, he got the letter just before Christmas, and I suppose we interrupted his holiday, but he wrote back that they were very disillusioned and disappointed with the letter from NCCJ's ad hoc committee. And he made 13 specific responses in a footnoted analysis of our letter. And I selected a few examples which I think fairly illustrate the feelings and attitudes of the Concerned Christians group. Quote, "Restraint, fairness, good judgment, and a spirit of consideration for others is what we are doing by presenting the hidden side of Mormonism. Quote, we are not attacking people, but we are attacking doctrine." Quote, "You are correct that our activities are harmful, but to the Mormon Church's proselytizing program, and that's why they are upset by what we are doing." Quote, "Again, you stated that we are lying in our presentations. Why don't you name these lies or unfair portrayals of the LDS Church or its history and beliefs? There is no way this committee can do that. First of all, the Mormon can't tell you because he has taken an oath that he can't reveal anything or he will jeopardize his life." Quote, "Mormonism is a subversive plot and a danger to the community." Now, the words I emphasized, he had underlined in his letter, and that is why I vocally emphasized them. In March 1984, the NCCJ board held its regular meeting. Each member had been previously supplied by mail with both the letter of the ad hoc committee and the Concerned Christians response. The board unanimously supported the position taken by its ad hoc committee. However, there was considerable debate concerning determination of the most responsible methodology for making the board's views known. There was no desire to give Concerned Christians additional publicity. And we were advised by the publisher of a major newspaper that if we issued a press release, that as a matter of policy, his reporters must give equal space to the response of the other side. Ultimately, the board decided that an advisory letter detailing its findings should be sent to the bishops and executives of the religious denominations headquartered in Arizona, and that they be requested to share any relevant portion of our statement with their constituencies. The advisory letter was mailed in mid-March 1984 to 21 members of the Association of Bishops and Executives list, which was provided to us by the Arizona Ecumenical Council. Subsequently, the statement was published by the National Program Office of the NCCJ and sent to all 75 regional offices for their information and as a guide for dealing with religious controversy. Now, against this narrative backdrop, it's important to make several comments. In a free society such as ours, proselytizing, public evangelistic campaigns, and conversionary efforts are the unquestioned right of every religious group. But are there not some operational ground rules which ought to be considered and self-imposed, especially in the light of the pluralistic society in which we live? Is there not also a responsibility to avoid unnecessary public religious controversy? When missionizing is done, it should be based on the positive virtues and merits of the adherent faith. Scrupulous effort should be made not to denigrate the sacred institutions, literature, or the historic personages of another religious group. Be fair. Be honest. Don't deliberately distort or misrepresent what any other group believes in order to advance your own cause. History should be treated objectively and without revisionism. Stereotypes and unfair caricatures of others should never be employed. We concede the right of any group to claim that it has an absolute corner on all religious truths. But aren't there some considerations which such true believers should weigh before they enter the public arena to debate others? What will be the effect on community peace and harmony when contending groups holding opposing absolutes meet and clash? Is the triumph of one man's point of view so imperative that the feelings and beliefs of others can be totally disregarded? To me, there is a proper place for humility when someone represents himself or herself as speaking for God. The wise words of Isaiah spring into my mind, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Surely, this scriptural admonition applies both to the brightest intellect among us and to the most literal, fervent believer. For myself, I doubt that any human interpreter of the Almighty has a monopoly on truth. I respect Isaiah's wisdom. We also assert the right to be left alone. There are simply those people who do not wish to be the recipients of even the most well-intentioned proselytizing efforts, and we ought to accept and respect that. In my work, I learn frequently of Jews who face a steady stream of efforts to win them to Christ. Mailings are sent to their homes, telephone calls, radio programs aimed specifically at them, repeated visits by determined callers. Such attention is not welcomed by most Jews, no matter the professed affection, love, or good intention of the would-be evangelist. I am not alone in suggesting that this sort of activity demonstrates not only a kind of contempt for the Jew and his relationship to God, but also an affinity for perpetrating spiritual genocide on the Jewish people. Mormons should understand this. Since the issuance of our rather cautious and emotional statement about the God-makers, my office has received many communications. A typical letter from a missionary to the Mormons states, quote, "I happen to care about the Mormons too much to allow them to go on in their deception. They need to be saved." The language suggests religious paternalism at the least, or spiritual dictatorship at the worst, and I find either to be extremely objectionable. I find far more acceptable the idea that every person has an inherent right to work out his or her own relationship to God. I doubt the validity of conversions made by compulsion, however subtle, however gross. Part of our heritage is the right to be wrong in the eyes of other fallible humans in matters of religious conviction, and not to be harassed because of it. For it is to God alone that we answer, not to finite human minds. The right to be left alone exists even if one is totally convinced of the falsity of another faith. I receive word almost daily of the pain felt by Roman Catholics who see many campaigns directed against their church. At the present time, blatant attacks are being made against them which blame them for every tragedy of human history, ranging from the assassination of Abraham Lincoln to the Holocaust of the 1940s. Leaflets, posters, and newspapers question their patriotism and make slanderous remarks about the current Pope and other prominent clergy. To me, this kind of behavior is intolerable even from those who totally reject Catholicism. The progression from negative attitudes through verbal assault to physical violence is real. In my own community, I witnessed beleaguered Muslims seeking to build a mosque. They were reviled. Bullets were fired into their homes. A pipe bomb was placed in a mailbox of a believer. I am grateful that the majority within the religious community stood in solidarity with their neighbors of Islamic faith, condemning these attacks. The mosque is complete and is now a showplace for faith. But this is not new to Mormons. Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitton have written of your history, quote, "Theirs is the story of a religious minority, generally unpopular and often harassed. A group that some scholars think was the most persecuted religious community in early America. The intergroup friction between the Mormons and their neighbors tells something about American society and the limits of religious tolerance." End of quote. Surely, in modern America, the times call for a new relationship of respect among the religious groups which now live in our land. I find especially helpful these selected statements of your prophet Joseph Smith. Quote, "It is a love of liberty which inspires my soul, civil and religious liberty to the whole of the human race. Love of liberty was diffused into my soul by my grandfathers while they dandled me on their knees. And shall I want friends? No." Quote, "If I esteem mankind to be in error, shall I bear them down? No, I will lift them up, and in their own way, too, if I cannot persuade them that my way is better. And I will not seek to compel any man to believe as I do, only by way of reasoning, for truth will cut its own way." I can live with that. In fact, we all can. Thank you. We would like to thank our panelists tonight for the outstanding papers we've heard.